Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He is Joel Blank. I'm Patrick Creighton in for new papa Jeremy Branham. It's The Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5, with our man Brandon Riley on the other side of the glass. And, of course, you get us on the HRMP guest line, 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN. On the text line, on Twitter, at PacManJoel, at PCreighton1, at BrandonRiley_. You get us on the Twitch channel, twitch.tv/ESPN975, on the ESPN 97.5 app, ESPN975.com. Tell Google, tell Alexa to play ESPN 97.5 and take us with you everywhere that you go. You know you want to. Now, first things first, I got to give Joel and Paul a ton of credit, because yesterday they did something that nobody in the city can do. They had Cal McNair on, and they had Cal McNair in studio. And Cal McNair doesn't appear on anybody. He doesn't even appear on the flagship. He would only appear on Texans-controlled media, yet somehow you guys got the biggest guest of the day in studio. Congratulations to both of you. That was an awesome show.
How do you mean biggest?
Most prominent.
Biggest, oh, I thought biggest you just guest. Meant by, like, overall girth.
Maybe that as well, but it's still very, very impressive that you were able to land.
Did you want ketchup or mustard with your hot dog and hamburger, Pat? We don't have lefties anymore, so I'm here to serve.
Thank goodness we don't have lefties. By the way, that was the absolute worst cheesesteak place.
Never had it.
It was awful.
I heard very, very mixed reviews on it, but never had it.
Absolutely awful. I went in one time thinking, hey, you know what? I'm here. I'm in this area. I've heard a lot about it. Let me go try it out. It sucked. The reason they're not here, they sucked. If you didn't go, you didn't miss it.
But maybe that's why they didn't have enough money to pay their rent, because they went out of business.
Well, like I said, I won't miss them, and neither should you. Now, last night, while this game was going on, you, Brandon, and I had the little pre-show chat going, and look, it was a game where if you weren't watching the Astros, well, it was like, you better get to the television. Justin Verlander had a no-hitter through 6 innings. He'd also thrown 91 pitches to that point. No hits, no walks, 10 strikeouts. The only base runner came when Martin Maldonado could not handle a strike three. But 91 pitches and Justin Verlander coming out of the game with a no-hitter. Ryan Stanek coming in, of course, gives up a hit to the first batter he faces. But
Correa.
The idea of JV with a no-no in a game where he struck out 10 of the, 18 batters to make out. Less than a week after Jose Urquidy was pulled, 2 outs into the seventh with 94 pitches. A lot of people in town were upset about Urquidy getting pulled at 94 pitches. Were you upset about Verlander being pulled after 6 at 91 pitches?
Upset? No. That's a different, I would use a different term. I was surprised simply because of what we've seen of JV all season long. JV's the guy that's pushing the envelope. JV's the guy that's trying to see what are his boundaries and has gone over 100 pitches before. So as I was watching the pitch count as he got into the sixth, I thought, well, he's got at least one more in him, but it's going to get controversial. And I'm curious what conversations, and I was curious to watch the dugout on which conversations could possibly happen if he did what it looked like he was going to do, which is cruise through the sixth, be somewhere in the 80s, knowing he could go into the seventh. But then if he got through it unscathed, that's where I was interested to see with him and Dusty and the law firm of pitching coaches and whoever else, would they decide to try and push it further? Because I didn't think there was any way he was getting into the eighth or the ninth. But the fact that they pulled him after 6 was a bit surprising to me because of the fact that he really didn't have any high leverage situations. The fact that, he got into a couple of long at-bats that kind of added to the pitch total. But I thought, he'll go one more. He's been over a hundo this year. He'll get into the 105s or the, you know, the one. If he gets close to 110, you got to pull him in my mind. But I thought he'd go one more inning. I was not shocked that they weren't going to let him go all the way through for the no-hitter.
All right, you and I kind of on the same page in that regard. I wasn't overly surprised that he didn't stay in for the seventh. Did I think that he could have gone at least into the seventh at 91 pitches? As you said, he's gone over, you know, 103, 104 a couple of times. If he had gone into the seventh, he had been in zero high leverage situations. He hadn't even been in medium. He was mowing guys down.
Mm-hmm.
He was never in trouble at all. Okay, you know what? He gets into the seventh, and he gets two outs, and he gives up a hit. Okay, take him out there. He gave up his hit. Now it's not, quote, a no-hitter anymore, and he's probably up around 100 pitches. He got his work in. I'm not upset they took him out at 91. I did think it was interesting to see the number of people who were really upset about Urquidy coming out at 94. With a very different tune when it came to Justin Verlander. And I don't necessarily think there should be a different tune when it comes to Verlander. Verlander, of course, is coming off Tommy John surgery. He is a test case for the elite pitcher at an advanced age coming back from that serious procedure. It's never been done. A guy like him to have that surgery at age 38. And for what he is doing this year, the way he is pitching, this is, you know, fresh ground broken.
Patrick, without argument, I don't think from anybody that's a sane Astros fan, he's the second most important player on this team, next to Yordan Alvarez. Yordan Alvarez is the key that makes every engine that has Astros offense associated with it go. And he has to be there. That's why we've said, handle him with kid gloves and putting him in the left field because you can ill afford to get him hurt. From a pitching perspective, and we saw this a year ago without Justin Verlander when arguably McCullers was your ace. But once you lose your ace, you lose a whole lot. Not just that every fourth or fifth day, but you lose that kind of aura that goes with it going in that you have a pitcher of dominance, that the other team knows that every single at-bat, every pitch is important because they're going to have to squeeze out some runs because normally they're going to be facing one of the best of the very best. So the fact that this guy is hyper-important and for everything that you said, there's no way that you put caution to the wind because he needs another no-hitter. And let's also bury it. You may think differently. He pointed at his arm to basically say he was being careful with it when he was letting the other pitchers know he wasn't going back out there. I don't think for anybody to indicate he had elbow problems.
No, not that he has an elbow problem. He's being smart.
Yeah, he's just being smart. Like, and I think that Astros fans have to digest that and realize, look, we've had a lot of concern in the past because Luis Garcia had never pitched as many innings as he had pitched a year ago. And everybody was losing their mind like, they've got to be careful. They've got to be careful. No one is more important to the success of this team for the rest of the season as it relates to the playoffs than Justin Verlander from a pitching perspective. You have to be more careful with him than anybody else.
100% agree. But at the same time, as you mentioned about Garcia, you know, Garcia threw, I think, 60 innings last year, more than he'd ever thrown mm-hmm. before. He hasn't quite been as good this year.
Right.
That is something that's not a statistical anomaly. These are facts and statistics and numbers where you go back 70 years on guys who have thrown more than 50 innings above their career high, and the next season they tend to be less effective and they're at greater risk of injury.
Take it a step further, Pat. It's not just the amount of excessive innings and the long-term effect. It's also whenever pitchers are chasing a no-hitter, and they extend themselves too far in terms of the amount of pitches they throw in a given game, and it's by a significant amount, there's a fall off. Sometimes it's a fall off for a week or two or whatever when your arm's trying to recover and you're still on schedule. And obviously, the Astros have an advantage over anybody else. They can go with a six-man rotation. They can give you some extra time. But you can also bowl the rest of your career. Your boy from the Mets is a perfect example.
Johan Santana is the example.
You go and get chase that no-hitter, and you throw a massive amount of pitches, and you go well over your normal amount of pitches. You could screw the rest of your career. And at 39 coming off Tommy John, whether it's for this season or for the long term or both, you just don't push JV.
And as much as I liked Terry Collins as a manager, Terry's inability to make the decision with Johan essentially ended Johan's career.
Mm-hmm.
Because he threw, 137 pitches and a no-hitter.
138, yep.
And his arm fell off a month later.
But you look at the kid from the Angels that got it earlier this year, and he got the no-hitter, but he threw a ton of pitches, and he was sent down a couple weeks later because he couldn't find the zone, and he didn't have the same velocity, and he wasn't the same pitcher. And you see this a lot. When guys are trying to do something they don't normally do because they're chasing the no-no, it can have a whole lot of negative effects for the rest of the season.
And for people who are like, well, you know, don't you think Justin Verlander would want a no-hitter? A, when you saw the camera and he's talking to the two other pitchers and he's pointing to his elbow going, look, I got to be smart. That told you what Verlander's goals are. Verlander's goals are based in October. They're based on chasing 300 wins. They're based on chasing 4,000 strikeouts. Those are things he's going to need to pitch another 4 or 5 years to do. And getting as many rings as possible. He doesn't need to have a no-hitter to throw to get Cy Young this year as he lowered his
lead
leading.
He's got the Cy Young wrapped up. He's, you know, there's going to be other ample opportunities for him if he keeps pitching like this, that he'll chase another no-no or two. I know that if he gets one more, it puts him in a very elite category. But at the same time, he also realizes there's a bigger fish to be fried this year, and that's the World Championship and the World Series trophy. And that was not the time to do it against the Minnesota Twins in August.
Verlander is now 16-3 with a 187 ERA. It is not a far-fetched idea to think he's going to win 20 games this year and have a sub-2 ERA and win Cy Young at 39 years old coming off Tommy John and just continue to essentially write a record book that has never been written. Much into the line of how well Verlander has pitched, different guy on that team is not pitching particularly well. We saw him pitch yesterday. Is this particular guy...
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Here's Joel Blank. I'm Patrick Crittenden for Jeremy Branham. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. And look, we were trying to talk about this during the break. And Brendan had asked, you know, does Justin Verlander ever chase another no-hitter again? And I'm kind of with you on this, Joel. If he can throw a no-hitter and be around 105 pitches, then, yeah, I think that he's got a shot to chase one at some point. I would venture, when Brendan said, you know, will he ever throw 120 pitches? I would never let a 40-year-old pitcher throw 120 pitches.
No. That's what I'm saying. Look, we had this, it was a pretty good discussion that just kind of parlayed from the first segment into the break, and Brendan said for the record that he doesn't think he's ever going to get another no-hitter. I said he's going to be chasing one, and I think that the thing to me is that you're still going to be smart. I mean, you're going to do what you did last night again and again and again if he's over 100 pitches. But there have been times, whether he's given up a couple hits or not, that he's gone into the eighth inning in the low 80s pitch count-wise. If he can get to the eighth and ninth inning and he's still like low 90s, who knows? You can have a single-digit inning here and there, and guys are going to be chasing a fastball trying to do that, what they need to do to get that hit on the board, that you could, I think he's going to chase it. Now, I don't know. There's no guarantees ever a guy's going to get it, but I think he'll have a couple opportunities.
I am more forgiving of last night. And forgiving is the wrong word. It was the right decision. But in the future, when he's not, you know, a year off of Tommy John's, I hope they let him chase it if it means 120. I'm not letting him go 130, 140, 150. If we're talking about the difference between 105 and 120, those moments are too exciting. Like, those moments are fun. They're memorable. They mean something.
I'll tell you that there is a massive difference.
There is.
In the amount of recovery time.
No question.
He can take a month off.
But here's
two
things. Here's two things, guys. That's why. That,
a month off.
It's also vital, if he wants to do those things, that he stays with the Astros. Because, for one, they have the luxury of going six-man rotation, which most teams don't do. So if he does go for it and chase it and it gets into this 110, 115, 120, you can give him extra time because of the six-man rotation. And the other thing that factors in is, as we've seen in the past, what JV wants, JV's going to try and get. So, therefore, he's going to go get it because he knows that these are the – look, I'm telling you, the echelon that he gets into if he throws one more no-hitter with multiples to that level is something that means a lot to him, just like 300 wins, just like the strikeouts. And that's going to be a thing where he might actually put his foot down and go, I want this.
And I probably care more because, you know, Verlander was a Detroit guy. I really want to see him get one more. I just think, like, if he's never going to be allowed to throw 120 pitches again, he's probably going to never throw a no-hitter again. And it's frustrating with how many times he's teased us with it this year. Three times this year, he's gone six innings or deeper with a no-hitter. And if he's never going to be allowed to throw more than 105, I just don't think he has another chance. I think, you know, we're just going to get we're going to get teased with it regularly for the rest of his career, and he'll never do it again.
First of all, being teased with it is not a bad thing.
I don't know.
No matter how many blue balls he throws at you until he gets taken out, he can tease all he wants. Every Astros fan will sign up for it. It's just to actually finish the deal, it's going to really rely on pitch count. It's going to and what part of the season are you in, too? That's going to be a vital factor.
That's fair. You know, you're so close to the postseason at this point. They said they're going to a five-man rotation. Like, as frustrated as I was yesterday, and I was, I'm not going to sit here and argue they did the wrong thing. I just worry if it means we'll never see a chance again.
Yeah, it's. I think he's gonna. He'll have at least one more opportunity. And like you said, when you just talk about numbers like that alone, Brendan. I mean, the fact that he had multiple times going into the sixth inning with a no-no already this year, and he's just coming off Tommy John, and there's no signs of him falling off.
But the pitch count has been of note in every single one of those. I literally remember every single time we've watched Verlander go deep in a no-hitter. We're sitting here going, "Is he going to be able to get that deep? Can he throw enough pitches to do it?" Every single time.
But here's the also thing. As you get further away from the surgery, there's a likelihood that you'll be a little bit more lenient with how many pitches he throws. But the first year, with the load that he's already put on his arm that no one expected him to do to this point, and he wants to continue to ramp it up more, is something that, and like you said, the key factor even that goes into last night is they're going back to a five-man rotation. We warned you this was going to happen as they get closer to the playoffs because they have to get their top four guys ready to be able to endure everything that they're going to face in the playoffs. So that makes sense. But in say, June of next year, if he's teetering in the 80s and 90s in the eighth inning, but he's got a no-hitter, I think they're going to let him go a little further. I don't know what you think.
I think it's too early for them to go back to the five-man rotation. Right now, Verlander and Fromber are both tied for second in innings pitched, 149. Now, usually a guy coming back from Tommy John surgery is going to be held at about 160 innings. We've seen in the past when guys go over 160 innings, there's arm issues the following year. Nobody wants to see Justin Verlander turn into Matt Harvey. Matt Harvey threw 215 innings coming off Tommy John surgery. His arm was a noodle the next year, and his career was basically over. I want to see Verlander have his shot to pitch four or five more years and go chase some milestones.
I mean,
so I'm concerned about the workload of Verlander because, look, Verlander is – he leads the league in innings pitched per start. You already know he's got that I want the baseball mentality. When you get into the postseason, the expectation is the Astros are going to go deep into the postseason, which means he's probably going to make five starts. Six starts. It's going to make a lot of starts. Justin Verlander probably not pitching three innings per start, probably pitching six innings per start. It's another 30-plus innings that he's going to tack on to it. Justin Verlander is on pace to throw over 200 innings this year with the expected postseason workload. Everything about his season is unprecedented. Some of it is phenomenal, the way he is pitched.
He's
the
a freak
ERA.
Of nature.
He is. But how far do you need to push that envelope?
But you shouldn't. The thing is, he's going to, and that's where I've said this in the past, he has to have people keep him from himself because there are times already, and it was too early in the season in my mind, when he started saying, I need to get to 100 pitches. I need to get there. There was a time for that. I thought it was too soon. He's persevered. He made it through. Again, he's a freak of nature. At 39, coming off that surgery, to be maybe better than he was prior to the surgery is just unheard of. But you don't want to push it too far. So if you're going to get him back to a 5 days rest instead of six, I mean, five-man rotation instead of six, and you're going to get him one last day of recovery, then it's smart to not get him over 100 pitches right away. And because of the amount of games, like you said, he's going to pitch in the postseason, it's smart not to push it too far too fast. You have to kind of pad the brakes and keep him from himself because if it's up to him, he's going to continue to push the envelope.
Now, I get the, all right, look, we could go back to a five-man rotation, right? Because they've had a couple of off days, and they're going to have a couple more off days coming up. But they're going to go from September 9th to the 26th without, until they get an off day. So they're going to go about a little over 2 weeks before they have an off day. I would have gotten through that stretch. Then use that off day on the 26th to reset at 5 men. Just to keep that, that would have saved them, what, maybe an extra 2 starts? And maybe that, it's not like they're chasing anything. It's not like anybody's chasing them. The division is locked up. The division's been locked up.
I mean, we've talked about it over and over again. They're in a very, very enviable position amongst teams in Major League Baseball. They have the division wrapped up. They have a top 2 seed wrapped up. And right now they have a, what, 3-game lead for the number 1 seed in the American League. There's really nothing to play for. That's why we said back to the conversations about Trey Mancini in left field and Chaz in center field and trying different guys at different positions. You have a luxury of being able to do that because of the pad that you have. With that being said, you can do what you need to do with your pitching staff as well. We can see from a bullpen standpoint, more rest doesn't seem to be the answer. We can see from a pitching staff perspective, they have been hyper careful and gone to that 6-man rotation for the majority of the season. But I also said at a certain point, they're going to go back. I agree with you. It may be too soon to start tinkering with going back, but the days off, the way the schedule, where they went through that stretch again, where they didn't have a day off for 19 or 20 games, now you're going to see more games off, and I think that factored in as to why now was the time for them to go back to a 5-man.
Now, with this change back to the 5-man rotation, who sits?
Right now, to me, it's Luis Garcia.
I would agree. He's been the lowest. He's been the least performing.
Let me say this, though, Pat. It's also because of what you're heading towards for the playoffs. I think we can both agree. Luis Garcia, no matter what they do, is not going to be one of the first 4 guys in their rotation in the playoffs. You're going to choose between Christian Javier, Luis Garcia, and Jose Urquidy, assuming that Lance McCullers is going to be a part of it the way he's been pitching, till you be your first 4 in the playoffs. So you might as well, the same way we were talking about with the pad to try different things and get guys ready to do different things or see if they can do it for the playoffs, position-wise, same thing with Luis Garcia. See if he can be a bullpen guy. Use him more frequently in the bullpen in shorter doses. See how long it takes him to recover. See how long it takes him to get loose. Get those things out of the way now so that you can factor in what he can, can't do and where he will be as a member of your bullpen.
See, I feel like Garcia going, like if it's, let's say it's Garcia, right? Mm-hmm. For all intents and purposes, let's just say it's Garcia. I feel like they will use him in a tandem start.
You don't think there's ever a situation where, because Javier is also going to be a guy that I could easily see with the way the back end of this bullpen is performing, I could easily see them saying, you are now our 8th inning guy. You are now our this guy. And then Garcia becomes your long relief guy and does a lot of the things Javier has done in the past. I don't want to label him as just a split start guy.
I think while you look at, you know, the way Javier is pitched and you say he's certainly capable of doing that from a performance standpoint, there is the idea that they've never used Javier like a true high leverage reliever.
Right.
They've used him in multiple innings and then given him 4 days.
But isn't that
off
what we're talking about right now between now and the end of the regular season? You could start grooming him for that?
That's a lot of grooming at the very end of the year for a guy who started all season long. Mm-hmm. That you're going to completely change everything about how he's prepared himself, and now you want him to do something different. I think there's a lot of risk involved in that.
Well, okay, but there, I mean, obviously there's risk in everything we're talking about, including how long you go with Verlander. I think that the fact is that you don't have to do it like immediately. But you could ease him into getting more frequent appearances out of the bullpen if that's truly where he's going to be too.
I think there's a certain amount of risk when you talk about Verlander pitching 7 innings, but I think that's a risk you can mitigate. When you're talking about changing the way a pitcher prepares for everything, I think that's a much higher risk. We'll get more into this as well as some issues with the bullpen coming up on the other side. Killer Bees.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
He's Joel Blank. I'm Patrick Creighton for Jeremy Branham. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. The idea of taking a guy out of the rotation and using him, not just as a reliever, but using him in a method of relief that he's never been used in before. For a team that has issues with workload and has concerns about injuries, and you're talking about a guy in Christian Javier who is likely to be throwing more innings this year than he's ever thrown in his career, I'd be very concerned about the potential injury to Javier, considering greater workload than he's had ever in his career and certainly more than he's had in the last 4 years, and completely changing his entire preparation routine to go from, you know, the way you prepare as a starter, doing your midweek long toss, to being a reliever, and it's, hey, look, you got 5 minutes, get it together. I'd be concerned about that from keeping his arm in a healthy state.
I've done both in college, and you're right. There's a different prep. There's a different recovery. There's a lot of differences. But what I would say is that there's also a difference in the fact that instead of every time you get the ball and toe the rubber, that you're throwing 60 to 100 pitches, that in most cases you're throwing less than 30, and more frequently than that, you're throwing, you know, 20, 25 or less, to where it's a lot easier to come back the next day. You're right, it's an adjustment. And I think it relates to both pitchers. I think from a Garcia perspective, no matter what you do, it's the right time right now to start bringing him out of the bullpen and getting him experience doing something he hasn't done the way he's been a starting pitcher.
Now, since you pitched both start and relief, how did you find that your arm would bounce back when you were on a normal starting schedule versus when you were pitching relief? Because John Smoltz, who, you know, for the most recent generation, people would remember John Smoltz, Hall of Fame pitcher, elite starter, suffered elbow injuries, was a closer for a couple of years, went back to being a starter, said being a reliever took too much out of him, and he preferred to start. That's him. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to be different. How was it for you?
I did as well. I did as well because of the fact that you have multiple days. The first day is always hell as a starter because you have overtaxed your arm and you wake up the next day and it hurts to move your arm and whatever, you know, and pick it up over your head or, you know, reach, do common things, and you're icing and you're doing all those things. But as a relief pitcher, it's more or less loosening it the second day. You can get through, and it's a lot easier to get ready and go out there. But it's different. You know, the differences are, most times as a starter, you face a couple of high-leverage situations throughout the entire start. Most times as a reliever, almost immediately you're going to be in a high-leverage situation where there's going to be some sort of pressure on you. And that's only going to grow as you throw more pitches in any given game. And the next day you're going to do the same thing again. And don't kid yourself, mentally, it also, that has a huge effect on what you do physically and how your arm and what you expect your body to do when you know that it's a high leverage situation and you're all revved up. I think that it was more difficult for me to come back the next day, because if you did throw and if you're lucky enough to throw 10 or 12 pitches, you're fine. But if you throw anything over that and then they want you to get all ramped up again, and then you don't know how many pitches you're going to throw. But that was the more difficult thing, because you're not as sharp. Your breaking pitches aren't as sharp. A lot of times your fastball isn't at the same velocity. Sometimes the adrenaline can get you going and get you through. But I think it's a lot more difficult to be – you're right. I mean, it's more difficult to be a relief pitcher because of the frequency that you're going to throw and the more high leverage the situations are than it is as a starter.
Now, I wasn't a pitcher. But I would tell you that games where I played third base, my arm angle was different than games that I played second base. When you're playing third base, you're letting it rip every time you throw. Second base, you change your arm angle. You got to take a little something off the ball. You can't, you know, you might only be 25 feet from the first baseman. You can't uncork it at full speed at his face. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I would find is if I played third base for 4 games and then I had to move to second base, having to change the arm angle and change the way I throw, my arm would hurt the next day.
Well, I can tell you this. In high school, and obviously your college coaches don't want you to do this. In high school, I would start and throw the way I normally throw. If they needed me to come in relief before my next start, I would come in and I would almost submarine. I would sidearm submarine because it's a different action for your arm that doesn't tax the same all the same muscles, like you said, from the same angle as it did when I was starting. My dad taught me when I was younger that if I was playing first base in between starts instead of the outfield, that the most natural position and the most natural motion for your arm is underhand. So he said, when you're throwing ground balls to the infielders, especially coming off a start, throw everything underhand and don't do anything you don't have to do until you have to do it. If you got to make a throw in a game, then you got to make a throw during the game. But other than that, make sure you do everything throwing it underhand and in that natural throwing motion so it doesn't put too much on your arm.
Now, guys that I knew and guys that I've covered have talked about, if you know, as a starting pitcher, when you get into the postseason and you get into one of those all hands on deck type games, that if it was a guy's day to throw and it was an all hands on deck game, you wouldn't necessarily have the guy throw that day because you might make coming into the game for an inning be like they're throwing, they're in between start throwing. Did you find that to be the easiest way to do that?
Well, the easiest way to do it, yeah, is on your throwing day in between starts. It's just like a bullpen session. A lot of times if you got a guy with a scheduled bullpen session, but sometimes the people go, why can you put that guy in a game right now and use him in a relief stint? Well, it's because it's the day of his bullpen set. He was going to throw anyway. So he might, you know, he's just going to do it in a game. But it's different. I mean, it will, no matter what any pitcher tells you publicly on record, it's a different feeling. A bullpen session, there's no high leverage. You're just, you know, hitting the glove, hitting your spots, throwing your pitches. But if you're actually facing live hitters in situations that matter, it's different. But that's the easiest way to go about it. But I think that you can look at it from two different ways if you're looking at these guys in the bullpen. If you go the route that you had mentioned and you're just going to do split starts, that's the closest to a starter being a starter and just coming out of the bullpen. And that's easier for them to do. But if you do have a set role for them, like I had implied that you could at least consider Javier in one of your back end of the bullpen spots, you're right. That's a huge adjustment for him from what he's been doing all year, as opposed to last year when he was really jumping back and forth between starter and bullpen. And his arm, though it's not the healthiest recipe, he was doing both. So his arm was used to both, at least to some certain degree where he could do it more frequently from the bullpen.
I mean, think about, you know, 2019, game 7, and AJ's taking Greinke out of the game. And he goes to Will Harris instead of Gerrit Cole because they didn't want to bring Gerrit Cole in middle of an inning. They wanted him to have a
clean
inning.
Starter's not used to doing that.
But it's Game 7 World Series all hands on deck type game. Might be the one and only time where you can say, you know what, the hell with what you've done. This is one game for everything.
Also, I go back to the mental aspect. Adrenaline plays a part in that. If it's the middle of the season or the end of the season, or you're up 3-1 in a series, it's a lot more difficult for a starting pitcher to come in a relief appearance and be on point. If you're talking about Game 7 of the World Series and your adrenaline is through the roof and you want that ball that badly, it doesn't matter if you're coming in with one out or two outs in an inning or starting an inning. That's what you spent your entire career leading up to that point to do. You're just going to go out and get an out.
Right, go get one out.
Yeah.
Last night, Brian Abreu was brought into the game to get one out.
Don't start.
And he came in with guys on base.
How good did he look, Pat?
Are we talking about the first batter or the second batter?
Well, I'm talking about the fact that there wasn't supposed to be a second batter.
But you know, the kind of thing that we've talked about with Brian Abreu, which is guys on base, and you know, it gets a little dicey. But Abreu did manage to get the out, shut the game down. Astros gonna be with a win. Earlier in that game, Will Smith came in. And Will Smith didn't make it through an inning. Is this gonna be a deal that absolutely goes nowhere? We'll get to that next.
Talking sports with you, not at you. It's the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
He's Joel Blank. I'm Patrick Creighton for Jeremy Branham. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. Joel, Will Smith did not exactly equate himself in the favor of pretty much anyone watching. As could not get through one inning. As Smith came into the game yesterday in the eighth, gave up a pair of hits, got a strikeout, had to go get Hector Neris, had to go save him. So they had to go to Hector Neris to bail him out of the eighth. Neris comes in, gets a double play, so they get out of that inning. Is Will Smith broken? I mean, from the point of view of, much like the Astros, the Atlanta Braves have a history of getting guys right, getting the most out of pitchers. I was concerned about this deal when it happened because Smith was not pitching well for the Braves. And, you know, the Braves aren't the Pirates. This is the team that knows how to get the most out of their pitchers, just like the Astros have a reputation for getting the most out of their pitchers. Is this the guy the Astros are just not going to be able to get right, at least not this year?
You know what? You would think that, and it's interesting because of the fact that Dusty went to him right away. Used to him back-to-back days, used him three games in four nights, was doing all kinds of things to say, you know, because I'm sure of all the people he can't remember, he remembered a guy that was very effective against him in the World Series the previous season. But the fact that what he's shown you to this point, the frequency in which you use him, like you would like to use a lefty specialist, you can't do that right now. And the problem is exacerbated by the fact that it's not just him. You don't know when you look into that pen where Maton is and if he's broken. You don't know if Will Smith is broken. You don't know, you know, what you're going to get out of Abreu. You don't. So many guys in that bullpen have a question mark attached to them now. We talk about that circle of trust with Dusty. That circle's getting tighter and smaller by the day.
Circle of dust.
And it's, yeah, the circle of dust is getting really, really dry and really used up, and there's only a few guys that can fit into that circle right now. And unfortunately for, you know, Will Smith is just not that guy. And I don't know how many more times, again, you're at a luxury where you can continue to throw him out there because you've got such a big lead and you've even got a lead for the best record. But at a certain point, when you start mapping out that playoff roster, I'm not sure if he hasn't already played himself off of it, because we already know that there were lefties with splits. I mean, righties with splits that got lefties out better and more frequently than what he's been doing. So, loogie or no loogie, it doesn't matter which side of the body the ball is coming from. He's not effective as a left-handed relief pitcher, and therefore, you can't afford to throw him out there in the playoffs.
So, right now, Ryan Pressly in the circle of dust.
Yes.
Okay. Hector Neris in the circle of dust.
I think he's tiptoeing the line. I think, you know, he got you out of the Will Smith jam, but then he created his own mess the following inning, and he hasn't been stellar. He wasn't stellar on the road trip. I still believe that you have to believe in him as either probably your seventh inning guy or towards the back end, because you have limited choices. So I'd say he's still in for the time being.
I thought it was interesting. They mentioned on the broadcast yesterday, Neris had not gone more than an inning in any outing this year. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time they asked him to sit down and get back up. And, you know, we talk about this with relievers. When you ask them to sit down and then they got to get back up, a lot of times there's something lost.
Right.
It looked like whatever the juice was, it wasn't there when he had to come back out.
I agree.
For a second inning.
And you're right, and that does affect some guys to a greater extent than others. But I think that he still factors into your late inning usage because of the limited choices you have and because he's been a closer before. The thing that's more shocking to me, Pat, is he really doesn't have an out pitch. You would think that he's got a legit strikeout pitch, a swing and miss pitch that guys really have problems with. I mean, I guess you could say, his changeup?
He gets a lot of swings and misses.
Last night, and maybe it was just because it was in that second inning coming back, he just did not look like the same, like he had an out pitch.
No, well, like I said, like something was missing. Yeah. When he had to come back up, the juice was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, Neris has you know, swing and miss stuff. He strikes out 10 guys per nine. He's always been a guy who's gotten swings and misses. But that, seeing him having to come back out, even though he only threw two pitches, It's the mindset when you come back in off the bench, guys don't normally do it. So much of relief pitching is, like you said, it's the adrenaline. It's that rush of, I'm going to come in, I'm going to kick these guys' asses, and I'm out of here.
Well, factor in, too, the fact that he's coming in normally in the middle of an inning. So it's more high leverage. So that also ramps it up. When you've got a 3-4 run lead and you're coming in to start an inning fresh with no guys on base, it's just like closers that have a hard time closing when the save isn't on the line.
And that's pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
Rafael Montero, who maybe now is past whatever those yips were for 3 or 4 outings, is Rafael Montero in the circle of duds?
By process of elimination and, again, limited selection, yes, he's in.
Okay, I think we both agree Phil Maton not
out.
In the circle
maybe
of
maybe off the roster.
Ryan Stanek, circle of duds.
In.
Brian Abreu.
So you know how I feel.
I do, but we have to be fair about the fact that overall, he has pitched pretty well this
year. Here's what I'll tell you. He's in if you're only going to use him situationally when you have a multiple run lead and he's coming in low leverage. I still don't believe in him coming in if it's a one run game and there's high leverage situation with guys on base. I mean, he showed it again last night. What goes on between his ears is night and day, runner on, no runner on, especially, and it's even worse and it's magnified when he self-inflicts the wounds by putting guys on base.
Okay, so I think we're in agreement there as well, because I think Abreu is in the circle, but he's not in the inner ring of
he's
the
circle.
He's
in the circle where
he's on
he's
the
used.
Outer
right,
ring of
right,
the circle,
right.
Which is, if Abreu's coming in to pitch the sixth, If he's coming in to pitch the seventh inning in a game, either you're up three or you're down a run or whatever it is, you do not want. I don't want to see Brian Abreu coming in eighth inning, one run game.
Agreed.
You know, that's not the situation I want to see him in.
Yep.
We saw him last night because Dusty didn't want to go to Ryan Pressly. Pressly apparently was not available, and Montero was not available. So they were trying to get Neris to get him home. It didn't work. You saw they had Maton up and ready to start the ninth, they sent Neris back out there.
Yep.
When Neris got into trouble, they sat Maton down and they got Abreu up. That tells you everything you need to know about where Maton is and where Abreu is in the circle of dust.
Yeah, that tells you what the pawpaw gut feeling is, and the gut feeling is he's now out. Yeah, you just know that if it was just mop-up duty and there was a four-run lead and no one on base and you felt really good that the Twins weren't going to make any kind of a rally, then throw him out there. But Dusty's thought process with Maton has changed, and rightfully so. He's not giving you any kind of reason or encouragement for why he should be in.
Now, if we're talking about which starter, quote, would move to the pen, and we said, based on performance, it should be Luis García because he has been the worst of the current group of five starters, and Lance Piccolo Jr. obviously is going to start. You mentioned Javier. Javier would probably be the best performer for the bullpen. I guess this is kind of where that decision kind of hangs in the balance, right? Javier's thrown 112 innings this year. We're pretty much at Javier's high watermark. He's striking out almost 12 batters per nine. If he's coming in a relief outing versus a starting outing, he can just let it hang out. He doesn't have to
the tank. Yep.
Manage the bullets for 5-6 innings. For right now, if you had to put a guy in the bullpen, you're putting Javier.
Because he's been there and done that.
Okay.
Because he's been there and done that. But I will say this. I don't know where you're at with this, but Jeremy and I had discussed this multiple times. I'm not looking at Lance McCullers and penciling him into anything till I see multiple starts more than the two he's already given me. I said I got to see 4 to 7 starts. I got to see consistency. I got to see health. I got to see recovery. I got to see things that are going to lead me to believe that I'm not going to put all my eggs in his basket and we're going to go through a rerun of last season where he looks good for us, somewhere at some point in the playoffs, and then all of a sudden here an injury rears its head again. And now here you are, and you've already moved Javier to the pen, and now you're wondering, can I move him back to a starting role when we've got him to adjust all the things we talked about from an arm perspective and prep perspective to the pen? I'm not going to move Javier too quickly. And this is also to contradict what we were talking about, because I didn't factor it in enough. Until I know that Lance is 100% in and he could do this, and that you're right, he's going to be a starter if he can, I don't want to tinker too much with Javier because he's my insurance plan. I'm going to put Garcia there first because that's where he belongs based on, like you said, he's been the least productive of all the starters. I'm going to manage it a little differently with Javier simply because of the fact that if Lance has any kind of a slip-up or looks like he doesn't have his stuff or there's things he can't do or he's limited, whatever, health-wise or otherwise, Javier's your guy.
So if that's the case, you've kind of got to keep him on the tandem start.
Exactly why I changed my perspective.
And I get it because, you know, I'm kind of the same thing. It's like, if Javier's going to come in, he's going to go to the pen based on the way that you've used him, you're pretty much going to tandem him because if you've had him on, I mean, look, he's made 19 starts this year. To turn around and be like, okay, scrap all of that and get ready in 5 minutes, you might be asking too much for him to, A, maintain arm health, and B, maintain efficiency.
And obviously there's no guarantees. If you could tell me McCullers is good to go and he's going to be like he was in his first two starts and maybe continue to get better as he gets more under his belt, then I have no problem moving Javier to the bullpen right now.
I mean, when we get to the postseason, how do you feel about, look, Verlander, you're going to let Verlander run.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably going to let Fromber run.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tandem Urquidy and Javier, tandem Garcia and McCullers, and take that amount off your bullpen?
See, it goes to what Brendan was, when Brendan and I were going back and forth on this Verlander thing. The one thing when you bring about McCullers is, if you go by his first start, his pitch count was way down. He did everything you could have ever asked of him to do, or your dream scenario for him. The Atlanta game was different, and obviously he got screwed by a defensive play and then ends up giving up the bomb, but he still settled in and he was okay. I think if you think that you're only going to get five out of Lance, no matter what he does starting in the playoffs, then it would behoove you to think about a tandem. But I think if you believe Lance, not every start, but you can say that when he's out there, there's a good chance he's going to go six or seven, then I don't want to do a tandem start with him because, again, you're burning an extra guy in your bullpen, getting him prepared. You and I talked about this Monday, preparing him to be the back-end guy. But if Lance has it going, maybe you don't need him and go to him as a back-end guy.
Unfortunately, we're not going to know the answer to that probably for about another month of whether or not.
I said
not
I got to see. I prefer ready. Six or seven starts to see who Lance McCullers is going to be.
He's Joel Blank. I'm Patrick Reed in for Jeremy Branham. This is the Killer Bees ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. As we've been getting through this, let me ask you, Texans' final preseason game is going to be tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
Is this one particular rookie the most important guy on the field for you to watch tomorrow night next?